Well, we all know that we've been under restrictions from meeting as regularly over the last few weeks. And I don't know if it struck you, but it certainly has struck me as very odd. It seems very different not going to church on a Sunday. In my entire life, I've not gone weeks on end without going to church. So, you know, it's just a very odd thing. Only during extraordinary times does the church not meet. Only under very rare conditions, extreme conditions, does the church ever suspend its regular meetings. Well, for the last several weeks, the government has prevented us from meeting because of these extreme conditions that we are under. Many other businesses and other services were essential, so to speak, that's what they told us at least, and they had to remain open, but not the church. And I have found this rather frustrating and disappointing. These restrictions, of course, have been in place up until recently. Because of the Wisconsin Supreme Court case and the ruling, many parts of the state now are open and no longer under these restrictions. Many businesses, I'm told, opened immediately, and others are looking forward to opening in the near future. The state, my understanding is that they will probably come up with a new set of policies, or at least the governor, I think, is trying to install a new set of policies, but it remains to be seen what's going to happen in the near future. This brings up an important discussion, then, of the rights and powers of the government as opposed to, or in contrast sometimes to, the rights and the powers of the church. We have the government on one hand, we have the church on the other hand. Sometimes these powers come into conflict, and so we have to determine then what are we going to do when the government says one thing and the church says something else. So today I'd like to look at what the Bible teaches about these two often competing areas of responsibility, the government and the church. First of all, we know that Christians are citizens of two different kingdoms. As Jesus said in Matthew 22, "Render therefore unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and unto God the things that are God's," right? So I think what he's talking about there is there are certain responsibilities. There's a aspect of authority, or there's a realm in which we recognize the authority of God, and then there's a realm, or there's an arena of authority in which we recognize the authority of human government. Now, obviously, all human government is under God's control or under God's government, but still, we do have human government, and we also have the church or God's program for the world. And sometimes these two areas of responsibilities or these two arenas come into conflict. Well, we do not deny that we are members of this world or this system. We do have a citizenship here on earth. We have earthly obligations as citizens of the county, the state, and the nation. And the Bible tells us to be good citizens. You know, we typically don't rebel against the government. We typically do what we are told to do. If a law is reasonable and it's rational and there's no reason to disobey the law, we obey the laws. We try to follow the authority that dictates the rules of the government that they give to us. As much as possible, we obey the laws and we submit to rightful authority. But we also have to remember that we are citizens of heaven. In fact, Philippians 3:20 says, "Our citizenship is in heaven." We, as the Bible tells us, are strangers and pilgrims in this world. We live here, but our true and final home is elsewhere. You've probably heard that little song or the chorus, "This world is not my home, I'm just a passing through." And so we have to remember that our true citizenship is with the Lord in heaven. And that means that our primary loyalty is not to this state or this nation. We ought to be patriotic, I believe, but on the other hand, our primary loyalty, our primary commitment is not to this nation or state or county. Our primary commitment is to the Lord. Our primary loyalty is to God, and His policies far outweigh human policies. Our commitment to Christ's church ought to be stronger than our commitment to any political party. And so we have these two areas of responsibilities. We have citizenship in this earth or this state, in this political system, this human system, but we also have a citizenship in heaven. And so we have to keep those in balance. We have to remember both sets of responsibilities. Well, human government, secondly, has certain rights and obligations. Let's look for a moment, if you can find Romans chapter 13 in your Bible. We'll read just a few verses from Romans 13. This is the primary statement in the New Testament regarding human government and its responsibilities. And so we should be aware, we should understand what human government is for, why God instituted it, and what it's supposed to be doing. So let me just read through this passage and you can follow along. Romans 13 verses 1 through 7. Let every soul be subject unto the higher powers, for there is no power but of God. The powers that be are ordained of God. Have you heard that expression? The powers that be? Well, that's a biblical expression. And it's right here. And this is talking about governmental authorities. Whosoever therefore resisteth the power, resisteth the ordinance of God. And they that resist shall receive to themselves damnation. Now, condemnation is what he means there, judgment. Not the damnation of hell, but condemnation or judgment. For rulers are not a terror to good works, but to the evil. Wilt thou then not be afraid of the power? Do that which is good, and thou shalt have praises of the same. That is, if you do the right thing, if you follow the rules, the government will be happy with you. For he, this would be the government official or the government itself, he is a minister of God to thee for good. But if thou do that which is evil, be afraid, for he beareth not the sword in vain, for he is the minister of God, a revenger to execute wrath upon him that doeth evil. So isn't that interesting that Paul talks about the government or the government official as the minister of God? Well, that's because he is doing, hopefully he's doing, what God intends the government to do, primarily to punish the evildoer and to protect those who do well. Verse 5, wherefore you must needs be subject, you must obey, not only for wrath, but also for conscience' sake. For this cause pay ye tribute also, for they are God's ministers attending continually upon this very thing. Render therefore to all their dues, tribute to whom tribute is due, custom to whom custom, fear to whom fear, honor to whom honor. That tribute is talking about tax. Now, I don't like paying taxes any more than anybody else does, I suppose, but it is our responsibility to pay our taxes, to render unto Caesar, as Jesus said, what is Caesar's and unto God what is God's. Okay, so what does this primarily teach then? What is this teaching about human government? Well, it tells us we have to subject ourselves to the higher powers, since these powers are from God. In other words, it's under God's providential control that we live under the government system that we do. And we should be very thankful. You know, we could have been born in North Korea. We could have been born in some godforsaken place that has no decent governmental system. But instead, we were born in the freest and most prosperous nation in the world. And so it's a blessing to be here. Even though we may not appreciate the government from time to time, still, it's better here than it is in many, many other places. And so we should count our blessings. So we are under the higher power. We are to subject ourselves. If we resist rightful government authority, we are in effect resisting God. The authority is God's minister, God's official for our good. And so when we resist that government authority, we are in essence or in some sense resisting God. Governmental authority then exists for two primary purposes: to punish the evildoer and to protect the good citizen. Unfortunately, our government goes way, way, way beyond those two primary purposes. And I think government would be far, far smaller and far cheaper and far better if it would focus on those two things: punish those who do evil and protect those who do good. I mean, that's where government ought to begin and end in my book. We should also remember that Paul wrote these things while a particular famous man was the Caesar. Do you know who the Caesar was when Paul wrote this? There's a guy named Nero. Have you heard of Nero before? He was a very bad man, a crazy man, a very abusive and corrupt man. And yet, Paul says, obey the authority, even though Nero was the highest authority. So that tells us that the government doesn't have to be perfect for us to obey it. We can't say, oh, the government has these specific problems, and so I'm not going to obey because it's corrupt or abusive. Well, talk about an abusive, corrupt government. Nero's government was the picture of that, and yet Paul still says, obey the governmental authorities. So we have to take that into consideration because we live in times when the government may be corrupt, and we may be tempted not to obey the government because it's corrupt, and yet there's still a sense that we are under that government and we should submit when we can. And so this is the default position. As much as we can, we are to submit ourselves to the higher authorities. We are to obey the rules, obey the laws, those that are rightful, those that are properly made, and those that we can submit to, we are to submit to, and normally we do that. We also should keep in mind that the government exists to protect our rights, not to provide our rights. What does the Declaration of Independence say? In part it says, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that we are endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights. Our unalienable rights come to us by virtue of the fact that God made us with those rights. God gave us those rights. And so the government does not give us our rights. It's very unfortunate that sometimes people in the government today think that our rights come from the government. The rights come from them. In fact, I maybe have mentioned it before, but I remember reading a little blurb by one of the Supreme Court justices that basically says our rights come from the rule of law. Well, law, the rule of law is a good thing, but the idea that our civic rights, our human rights come from the law is a very dangerous position, because what do we know about the law? It can be changed. And so if our rights come from the law, then guess who holds our rights in their hands? Those 9 members of the Supreme Court of the United States, and whatever they say is the law. Well, I don't believe that. I believe that our rights come from God. We are endowed by our Creator with our unalienable rights. And the purpose of the government is to protect our rights. That is, to protect us from violation of our rights. They don't give us our rights. They protect us. And so that's what government ought to be doing. By the way, the Wisconsin State Constitution clearly says in regard to religion, here's what is a direct quote from the Wisconsin State Constitution: control of or interference with the rights of conscience shall not be permitted. Control of or interference with the rights of conscience shall not be permitted. The rights of conscience, of course, are religious rights. So the state has no business controlling or even interfering in the rights of religion. And we also know that the federal constitution says that the government shall make no law prohibiting the free exercise of religion. So it's not the government's business to try to interfere with, to control, or to regulate religion. The government should not infringe on our religious liberty. Let me say just a couple of words about safety and risk. A lot of people today are very concerned about safety. They believe that it's the government's obligation to keep us safe and protect us from threats. And in a certain case, that's true, or in a certain way, that's true to a certain degree. We do believe that it's the government's job to protect us. We have a military, right? And we expect the military to protect us, to defend us. We have the Department of Defense. I was a part of the Department of Defense when I was in the military, and I was trying to protect our nation in a certain way. So we believe in the military, we believe in the police, we believe in the fire department, we believe in certain government agencies like the CDC and the FDA and all these different hundreds of government agencies that are there to protect consumers and protect the citizens. And so we do believe that the government is there to protect us in a certain sense. But there are some threats from which the government cannot protect us and should not try to protect us. Adults have to determine for themselves what risks they're willing to take. For example, if you want to go skydiving, that's a pretty risky thing, but it might be a lot of fun. And so if you as an adult decide to go skydiving, that's your right. If you decide to drive your car, I think all of us probably drove our cars to get here this morning, that is a risky thing to do. Most of us don't even think about the fact that we're doing something quite risky every time we get into a car. And there may be different routes to get from your house to here that make it more or less risky. And so all of us are doing risky things from time to time, whether we are sitting at home, whether we are out on the road, whether we're skydiving, whatever we're doing, there's some risk involved. And we really don't, I don't think, want the government to be like a cosmic babysitter of some sort that is prohibiting us or shielding us from all risk. We don't want the government to swaddle us with regulations and rules that prevent us from involving ourselves from any risk at all. The government is not a babysitter and it shouldn't act like one. It has to allow adults to make decisions for themselves as much as possible. And I think things work out best, generally speaking, when people have the maximum freedom to make their own personal decisions. And so even today, coming out today here to church involves some risk. There's a very small chance that someone might pick up the virus or transmit it to somebody else. Now, fortunately, again, we live in the whole county. This area of Wisconsin has either very little or none of the virus, at least nobody's been tested positively with it as of yet. So there is some risk, however, anytime you get a crowd of people or anytime anybody gets together, there's some risk, I suppose, of transfer. There's even a risk that somebody might get the disease and somebody might die of it. That risk is very low, and we have to weigh the risks of anything against the rewards. And so if we were to avoid all risk, I suppose we wouldn't even get out of bed in the morning. If we were that scared of every little thing that could happen to us, well, to avoid every risk, we wouldn't get out of bed. So obviously we're willing to tolerate some degree of risk, and we have to be willing to then weigh, here are the risks of going out and going to church, here are the risks of living a regular lifestyle, and here's the rewards of doing that. So all of us, at least adults, have to make those decisions. And we have the right to be skeptical when the government tells us that it's imposing restrictions on us for our own good, for our safety, and for our protection. People today are often willing to give up their freedoms for a guarantee of safety and protection. But we should remember President Reagan's memorable statement. He said the 9 most terrifying words in the English language are, "I'm from the government and I'm here to help." Well, we all know that the government can be quite opposite when it comes to helping people. In their efforts to help, the government officials often do the opposite. Government promises safety, but such safety often comes at a very high price. Many people want the government to protect them, but the cost of that protection often involves the loss of freedom. We should keep in mind what Proverbs 21 tells us. The horse is prepared against the day of battle, but safety is of the Lord. Ultimately speaking, safety is from the Lord. It's the providential will of God that really matters, not so much the government's imposition of restrictions to ensure our safety. Christians trust in the Lord, not the government, for safety. Ultimately, we're trusting God for protection, not the government. And that leads me into a few words about fear. I think many government officials have a vested interest in keeping the population afraid and uncertain and upset. The media and some politicians would like nothing better for this crisis to extend a few more months so that people would be upset and dissatisfied. So they keep up a constant drumbeat of fear-provoking reports. They envision the worst-case scenarios, and they dredge up the most extreme examples of suffering to keep people afraid and uncertain. The government also uses fear to motivate people so that they do what they are told. The government threatens people and in some cases arrests and punishes those who fail to follow the government policies. A fearful population is a controllable population. And there are some politicians who want nothing more than to control other people. They like the power. They think that they know what is best. And so they try to restrict people and put limitations and restrictions on people just because they want to do what they feel that they can do. And so a fearful population is controllable. In some cases, there may be a legitimate threat and a real reason to be afraid. We certainly do want the government to step in and do things in certain situations. If a disaster strikes, if there's a flood, if there's a famine, if there's a tornado, if there's a plague like what we've been experiencing, well, we do expect the government to do something about it. I think if the government just sat there and did nothing, most of us would be quite dissatisfied. We do expect, you know, the resources that the government has, we expect them to do something to alleviate the suffering. So all of us, I think, want the government to step in from time to time, especially in times of disaster. But it's also true that certain people in the government may use national disasters and fears to control us and even to impose greater restrictions on us than we normally would be willing to tolerate. In other words, during times of war or famine or disease or disaster, people are willing to allow the government to step in and put down restrictions and tell people what they ought to do or tell people what they must do or arrest people or whatever the government wants to do. We're willing to tolerate that because we recognize this is a crisis. And then once the crisis has moved on or the crisis is no longer such a threat, guess what the government tends to do? It tends to keep those restrictions in place because there are many people within the government who like to restrict people or to control people or to tell people what they can and can't do. You've maybe heard the old statement, I guess it's not a terribly old statement, but it's a common one nowadays, never let a good crisis go to waste. Have you heard people saying that? Politicians use crises to force upon the public things that they would never otherwise accept. Well, as Christians, we should not allow the fear of man or the fear of circumstances to be our primary motivation. The Bible tells us to fear God and keep his commandments. Our primary focus of attention always ought to be on God and what he wants us to do. And so God has not given us a spirit of fear, the Bible tells us. We should not cave in or capitulate to tyrants when they want to try to restrict our freedoms. And that's especially true of religious freedom. You know, we may be willing to tolerate restrictions in numbers of ways, but we have a constitutional guarantee of freedom of religion. And so we should not be willing to allow the government to put down restrictions that would permanently take away our freedoms. The government has proven itself, unfortunately, many times to be incompetent in various ways. Government officials have proven themselves to be power-hungry tyrants. The fact that government officials are making various claims does not guarantee that those claims are true and right and for our best interests. And so we need to be able to determine and decipher the things that are going on in our world today so that we don't simply give in or cave in to the restrictions or the regulations of tyrants. And then just one other thing that occurred to me as I was considering these things, and that is a little something about biblical quarantine. Do you know the Bible talks about quarantine? Have you read through the Old Testament lately, especially those books that talk about what to do in cases of various skin diseases like leprosy? Leprosy was, I don't know if it's a virus or if it's a bacteria, I really don't know what leprosy is, but it's one of those things that is highly transferable, and people in the Old Testament times and people in ancient times and really still today in some places in the world have to worry about the spread of diseases like leprosy. And so the Bible tells what to do in cases of leprosy, and what to do is you quarantine the person who is sick. When a pestilence arises, if we follow the biblical pattern, we would quarantine those who are sick, not those who are healthy. Now, I know that the current virus is not quite like leprosy, but I think, perhaps, in my opinion at least, I'm not a medical expert, I don't know a lot about these things, but if we follow the biblical pattern, we'd quarantine those who are sick and not those who are healthy. So I think things perhaps would have gone better for the world had the medical establishment followed the biblical pattern of quarantining the sick instead of quarantining everybody. Let's go on and look at the church and its rights and responsibilities, its obligations. The church, of course, the word church means assembly. So one of the main things that the church is supposed to do is assemble. The Bible talks about assembling regularly. In the very early part of the church, in Acts chapter 2, they were meeting every day, but eventually they started meeting on the Lord's Day. It's called the Lord's Day, of course, because we are celebrating to recognize and celebrate the resurrection of Christ. And the church carries out various responsibilities. Obviously, the church is engaging in worship. We're to honor and magnify the name of Christ. We sing, we pray, we give, we conduct the Lord's Supper and baptisms. These are all part of worship. We are involved in instruction. The Bible tells us to preach the word and to reprove and rebuke and exhort with all longsuffering and doctrine. We're engaged in fellowship. The church is a partnership, or the church is a community of people who share in one another's lives. We are engaged in evangelism. We preach the word of God, preach the gospel, and try to get the good news of Jesus Christ out to the world. And then we serve one another. We serve God by serving one another. Now, these are essential matters. I know that the government has not said that the meeting of the church is an essential thing, but it is, biblically speaking, according to the New Testament, conducting these obligations or fulfilling these obligations, going into all the world and preaching the gospel, having the regular meetings of the church, that is an essential thing. Unfortunately, some of the people in the government, especially some of the top leaders, they don't even attend church. They don't have any consideration for the church, and so they sort of put the church in a category of really non-essential. But these are essential obligations. We cannot put off the church and the work of the church indefinitely. There may be times when we can't attend church. There may be times under extreme conditions where we can't have the meetings of the church. I think it was maybe two or three years ago during the winter we had, three times during the winter that we did not have the service of the church because we were snowed out. Well, that's everybody understands when there's too much snow, there's bad weather, there's a tornado, there's a disaster, we don't have the meeting of the church on that Sunday. But that's a very extreme thing. That's a very limited thing. And so generally speaking, we're going to have the meetings of the church. We don't postpone them indefinitely. We don't say the church is closed for the next 3 months or something. We continue on with the work of the church. When there's a disagreement as to what the government wants us to do and what the church says we ought to do or what the Bible says we ought to do, Christians follow the higher law. As a general rule, as much as we can, we obey the authorities that God has put over us. The powers that be are ordained of God. We recognize that. And as far as we can, we obey the governmental authorities. We try to be good citizens. But there is a higher law than the human law, and that's God's law. And so obligations to God and his law far outweigh obligations to man. We have the right to disobey human law under two distinct conditions. So the Bible does indicate that we can disobey the rule of man. One would be if the government is forcing us to do something sinful. Can you think of any stories, perhaps in the Old Testament, where the government is trying to force people to do sinful things? My immediate thought goes to Daniel. Remember, they said that Daniel could not pray except only to this image of, I guess it was Nebuchadnezzar. And Daniel, what did he do? Instead of following the law, he prayed to God. And of course, he got in trouble for that. Same with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So the law told them to do something sinful, engage in idolatry. But in the early church, the believers were told that they could avoid problems simply by saying, Caesar is Lord. If they would simply say those words, Caesar is Lord, and burn a pinch of incense to the Caesar, the emperor, that would be good enough for the Roman authorities. They could get out of trouble by doing that. And they refused to do it. And many of them went to their deaths or to persecution or to slavery because they refused to say Caesar is Lord. So in those cases, you disobey the government when it is trying to force you to do something wrong. And thankfully, we live under a system that the church is not terribly restricted by the government. Here in the United States, the government does not impose too much on the church. I mean, the government has certain restrictions, but it really doesn't violate the obligations or the responsibilities of the church too much. But if they are trying to force us to do something sinful, we have the right not to obey that law. Also, if the government tries to prevent us from what God has commanded us to do, then we are obligated to disobey that rule as well. Again, looking back at the Old Testament, there was a time when the government authorities tried to prevent the people from rebuilding the temple. I just read that portion from Ezra, I believe it was, or at the end of Chronicles. It talks about rebuilding the temple, and the people there were trying to prevent them from doing it. And yet, the prophets of God stood up and said, no, we need to rebuild the temple. Keep on going. Don't stop. There's something that God has commanded us to do, and the government tries to prohibit us, well, then we can disobey that command. Over in Acts chapter 5, it says this, Acts chapter 5, 28 and 29. Did we not straitly command you that you should not teach in his name? This is what the government authority said. The Jews said this. Did we not straitly command you that you should not teach in this name? Then Peter and the other apostles answered and said, we ought to obey God rather than man. So when the government tries to prohibit us from doing something we must do, well, the option, the response is very clear. We ought to obey God rather than man. So sometimes it's hard to determine exactly if these conditions apply. Are they trying to force us to do something, you know, ungodly? Or are they trying to prevent us from doing something we have the obligation to do? When those things pertain, we have the right. We have the duty to disobey the government in those cases. Now, I'm really grateful that the recent ruling of the Supreme Court allows us to be here without violating the law or the policy that was put down by the state of Wisconsin. You may remember that originally we were talking about meeting outside in the backyard. Well, we'd be pretty uncomfortable and maybe pretty soggy today if we were sitting out there on the lawn. And in the providence of God, we can be here today and comfortable and sitting in the pews instead. So I'm grateful that we don't have to violate or bend the rules today because we have the freedom to be here. In the future, we have to decide what we're going to risk. I don't doubt at all that in the lifetimes of some of the young people here, the government may crack down or impose more restrictions on the church than any of us have ever seen. And so we have to decide, potentially at least, if we're going to follow the government policies and risk disobeying God's command, or if we're going to follow God's commands and risk violating government policies. So which is really the greater risk? Are we at greater risk if we violate man's commands or God's commands? Obviously, we want to do both as much as we can. Generally, here in the United States at this time, it's not a matter of obeying one and violating the other. Generally speaking, we can obey both at the same time. It's best when we can do both, but sometimes we can't. We must be willing to obey God and suffer the consequences. Just like in the New Testament, when the apostles disobeyed the Jewish authorities, they got in trouble. And you know what? We might get in trouble as well. If there's a clear-cut case where we must obey God rather than man, and if there are consequences for that, we have to be willing to pay those consequences. As the culture moves further from God, we should not be surprised when the government attempts to restrict the work of the church. And I think there will be more of that in the future. But I'm glad that we can meet freely today. Of course, we're not back to our regular schedule yet, but at least we can, for the foreseeable future, have regular meetings. So that's a good thing. The church should be aware of its rights and responsibilities. Even during a time of crisis, the work of the church must go on. The church is essential, no matter what the government says, and we should not allow a tyrannical government to prevent us from doing this essential work. It's often difficult to balance our obligations to the government with our obligations to the church, and I'm thankful that these duties often do not come into conflict. Usually we can do both, honor the government or obey the government and honor the work of the church. But when they do, when these things do come into conflict, and it seems like that conflict will probably be much more likely in the future, we must obey God rather than man. Let's close in prayer.